Radio.
Brendan, I got a real special guy here today.
Ooh!
He put in the request himself to come down.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lou Bega.
No, Lou Bega's still alive. Damn it.
I mean, not damn it that he's not dead.
I was gonna... Brendan, I know now. Look, I get you've been anti-Lou Bega for many years, but I don't know that we should wish him dead.
Poo on Lou!
I got a big guest today.
Big guest.
Request.
Own request.
Wanted to say hi.
Kelsey Grammer.
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jesus Christ. Hello, my friends. It is so nice to be here to meet you. I've come down from Republican heaven, both of them, because I do not take a side.
Mm-hmm.
Because I am a man of peace. You know this. You've read my book.
Jason, did this person tell you that they were Jesus?
Yeah.
Where did you meet them?
Look, I don't think that's important. Look, fact is, I'm still here. No, we're just having a little sidebar here. Don't worry about it, Lord. It is okay. Look, he's the real deal.
Okay.
I checked this. I double-checked it. I did background checks.
Mm-hmm.
I called hospitals.
Okay.
He's the real deal.
You called hospitals?
Yeah.
Like the manger?
Yeah, well, sort of. I mean, I just wanted to see if there was they lost like a Jesus guy, and
yeah.
None of them had.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So I'm pretty sure he's the real deal.
Okay, well, we'll just let him continue, I guess.
Come on back in, my lord. It's fine. Thank you.
Was he smoking?
Well, I mean, what are you going to do? Tell him not to? Okay. I apologize. If it is too much, I will put it out.
In the studio, yes.
All right. Excuse me, my children. I just wanted to stop by. I want to say you are doing my work with this podcast. You are expanding the word of the Lord through the lens of British film. Which, you must know, is my favorite type of film. I have, over the years, I have been watching your Earth and your people, and I have come to enjoy the British film most of all.
Okay, well, from the words of the Lord.
And in fact, I will go as far to say as my favorite British movie of all time is 1996's The English Patient.
Okay, Jason?
Lord, are you sure that's your favorite? Yes, absolutely. It was a romantic experience that I personally related to in a very, very deep way.
Well, I'm an atheist.
Whoa, shit. I don't want to say anything bad about you, because I'm not a blasphemer. There's one thing you can say about this guy, he's not a blasphemer. I appreciate that. That's right.
Goddamn right you're not.
But I just want to say thank you so much, Lord, for coming on the show and doing so little, but in totality doing so much. That is why I'm here. I only need to do a little bit. And if you will look in behind Brendan's laptop, you will find a small pot of wine and 6 sardines. And I have left them just for you.
Oh, wow.
So now I must return to Republican Heaven. There is a watch-along party tonight for The Masked Singer. We have our own version up there. So I must go. So I guess that's it.
Yeah, we'll see. Grab one of those and head on your way, buddy.
Okay. Believe in me, jetpack. That was really cool that he came all the way down here.
There's a little accent on the E in his first name. Are you sure this is the right person?
Yeah, no, it's the right guy.
Okay.
I saw the holes.
Accent aigu, as they say.
Was it an accent aigu?
Sure.
It's or one accent grave, perhaps? And that's all French. We're talking about what you assume to be a Spaniard. Are you a racist? Are you an ethicist?
This is a podcast
where we discuss British films specifically, Brendan. Tell me.
The British Film Institute Top 100 British Films of All British Time
as
list.
Established in the only year that matters, 1999, of which we were to party like it was, and we did, and when we did party like it was 1999, in 1999, you know what happened? We got a list of the 100 best British films of all time.
It was the year of our guest that we just had.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. He was there. He hung out with Prince that year.
Yeah, and
I saw it all over MTV.
And now he hangs out with Prince again.
Boom!
Because he's dead. See, we hit elbow to elbow because we respect COVID restrictions. That's why we're in the same room.
That's right. That's right. Hey, he's part of my, what do we call
consistent
it?
Consistent 10.
Consistent 10. Brendan is part of my consistent 10. We are following the law to all regulations.
And you're part of my, topsy-turvy 500. So
absolutely.
Perfect.
That's, That's great. That's a lot of fun we have with all those 498 other dudes. And make no mistake, it's all dudes.
Speaking of 498 other dudes, I have no segue for this. Jason, we need to talk about a movie this week on this list, on this BFI Top 100, because that's what we do. We go through this list every week, and we break down a movie off this list.
We do.
That's what we do normally. You know, we have fun sometimes.
Wait, are we doing something different this week?
No, we're not doing anything different.
Okay.
You, I have to go watch a movie. No, we're talking about a movie. We're not watching a movie. That'd be boring. We're talking about a movie on this list.
That might be a bonus episode, a watch-along, but that's later.
It's not even a watch-along. You literally will just hear us watching. You might hear it faintly in the background, the movie just playing.
You'll hear drinks being drunk. You'll hear farts and burps. Yeah. And all the ancillary sounds.
No jokes from us. Just watching it.
Oh, God. We should have done that with that four-hour Dr. Zhivago remake.
Yeah, we should have. Because a lot of I can't think of a single person who wouldn't sync that up.
We could actually probably sync it up ourselves and upload it. And nobody would copyright strike us because why?
Keira Knightley would be like, I was in that? Why am I naked?
They'd love that. That'd be the first time that movie got any notice whatsoever.
You know what? I just thought of it, though. If they didn't think that that movie had any kind of copyright thing, they would be like, why is that 16-year-old girl naked in this movie?
Well, maybe that's the thing. It has no copyright because nobody wants to claim it. They don't want to get charged.
I think we might get arrested.
Oh, well, we'll just blur it.
It's almost worse.
We'll put my face and your face over each of the breasts.
Okay, that's worse than her just being naked. Guys, Dr. Zhivago, Keira Knightley, very young, naked. It's weird. Yeah. Anyway, we're not talking about Dr. Zhivago.
No.
Either version. But before we talk about this week's movie, Jason, we do need to read some comments, of which I'm sure we have a few, about last week's film, Life of Brian.
This podcast is proudly presented to you in monographic stereo. One channel, that's enough. Monographic stereo, get it today on one speaker.
So let's get right into it, Jason. Let's read some comments about last week's film, Life of Brian. Start us off.
We've got so many comments today, Brendan, so we can't be fucking around,
Brendan.
Can't
be fucking around.
No fucking around. You understand me? Our first comment is from our serial commenter, Andrew Littlefield. Good to hear from you, Andrew. Andrew says, it's better made than Holy Grail. Agreed. More budget. It has more budget. And has a better ending, in that it has one. That's true. I like it more because it was ballsy for them to openly take on Jesus, even if Brian isn't Jesus. To date, it's the only movie I've seen to portray Israel the way it was, with multiple men claiming to be the Messiah. Classic. It's historical, says Andrew.
There you go.
All right, Brendan. Next comment. Go!
Eric, we need to comment on these a little bit. Otherwise, we're literally just shouting
out
the
comments. Gotta get this done. Go!
Eric Chung says, I watched Grail, Brian, and Life before I ever saw Flying Circus. My dad showed my brother and me these films, and this one was really late at night, so I think I had to finish it later. It's definitely my favorite. I did a reading of it last summer, and I requested to play Michael Palin's jailed character, because I've been doing that impression for more than 20 years. Go ahead. Do the
You look it. Look it, bastard.
There you go.
Yeah, Eric, that's great. Yeah, I love that character. But that's the thing. I'm a boy. I grew up watching Monty Python, so I did lots of Monty Python characters. I'm sure, Eric, you must have too if you watched some Monty Python. But
Monty Python and Blue Nui.
I object to all this sex on TV. I mean, I keep falling off. Let's see. Tom Hannigan. That's a good name. Good, solid name. Quarterback's name. That Tom Hannigan is playing for the Patriots this year. Great. All right. No fucking around. Let's get to this. I just saw Meaning of Life for the first time and thought it was just a higher budget Flying Circus. Some great bits, but inconsistent. Holy Grail is more consistent comedically, but it's not as good of a movie. Life of Brian is the best thing they've done from start to finish, and I agree. Absolutely. Meaning of Life is definitely in the spirit of the show.
Yeah.
With
sketches.
Thematic links rather than... Well, to be fair, in the show, the thematic links were kind of even tenuous until the later seasons after Cleese left, and they started doing more long-form kind of sketch.
Kieran O'Connell, this is an interesting point. It's interesting. Americans always seem to prefer Grail, while the Brits like Brian. Wonder if it has anything to do with Americans generally being more serious about religion.
Probably that, but also, I mean, as quotable as Brian is, Grail is just so endlessly quotable. I don't know if that's just because it's more successful in America, it's more quoted. But I feel like that's the one that always gets quoted. Mm. I still hear kids say, come back, I'll bite your legs off. All the time.
Yeah.
They're always saying it.
On the streets, In the waiting rooms across America and Canada.
In the sheets.
This great land of ours. Count all the votes. Sorry, Jason, keep going.
We're going down a path here. Wickham Clayton writes in. Hi, Wickham. Good to hear from you again. I'm sure we've heard from him before.
No fucking around, Jason!
I don't know too many Wickhams.
No fucking around!
No fucking around. I love this movie, but Holy Grail is the holy grail of the movies for me. Life of Brian's commentary is incredibly witty and insightful. There's so much to tear into it with its satirical approach that sort of gives it sort of gives up at the ending, which is memorable with that great song. It just doesn't fully realize its premise and goes with an well ending. I love that space battle, though. Yes, Wickham, as do I. I get that perspective. I think Brian's the best movie, but I understand why people think Holy Grail is, and that's a good case to be made, friend.
I get that criticism, and I will second that on the space battle, a scene that I completely didn't know existed before watching the movie.
It's a wonderful shot to the arm.
Wow. Leonard C. Chadwick says, it's my favorite Python film. As much as I love Grail, Brian is far more cohesive as a whole, and while it does have moments that telegraph the sketch comedy roots of the troupe, Big Nose, Halibut of Good Enough for Jehovah, etc., it never feels like it veers far away from the story it's telling about Brian. Further, the theme speaks to me on a personal level. As a non-believer who grew up very religious in an evangelical home, I love this movie to the core of me.
Nice. Nice. I love that kind of love, man.
It's evangelical.
That's right, evangelical Python.
I'll tell you about the life of Brian! The life of Brian! Okay, we can't fuck around!
Can't fuck around, Brian. All right, next comment. Matt Leach writes in, and Matt gets to talk about, he's talking about one of the bands I love. So, I'd say Holy Grail is my favorite. Here's a fun fact. Pink Floyd, great band, would often watch Python in the studio during recording breaks. When they heard that the Python lads were trying to make a movie, but were having trouble raising money for the band, the band gave them £200,000, but also convinced Led Zeppelin, Genesis, and a few others to chip in. Had it not been for those bands, we likely wouldn't have gotten any Monty Python movies at all. I love Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, and Genesis even more now.
Yeah, and I mean, we talked a little bit about that, I think, when we talked about Holy Grail, about the tax breaks.
Mm.
So there's definitely tax breaks included for these musicians that helped out. But that's what I think, too. I do think there was genuinely some love.
You can dodge taxes and do something good in the same way.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You don't see Wesley Snipes financing a Monty Python movie.
No.
All right.
You should.
My first namesake, Brendan Tennan.
Oh, wow. It's the first. We haven't had any Jasons write in, have we?
I guess we're best friends now.
All right, nice.
Sorry, Jason. Brendan Tennan says, absolutely love it, but I honestly go back and forth on whether I think Brian or Holy Grail is the best Python movie. As someone who studied Latin, when I saw this movie, so many of the jokes hit that much harder, so I'll always have a fondness for it in that respect, even if Holy Grail has way more quotable lines and gags. I saw John Cleese at a special screening of Holy Grail a few years ago, and he offered this interesting distinction between the two. He said that Holy Grail consisted of these perfectly constructed sketches that were kind of loosely connected together with an overarching plot, but that the scenes individually could stand on their own in an episode of Flying Circus. Life of Brian, on the other hand, has some very brilliant and hilarious scenes, but is much more focused on the plot and story arch of the characters. Because of that, he felt that Life of Brian was the best Monty Python movie.
I agree with that, and I like that perspective because, that to me maybe explains them why Holy Grail often stands out as more quotable, because those individual bits stand so strong on their own, whether it's, you know, help him being oppressed, or whether it's, you know, the Black Knight, or what, you know, the Frenchman, like they all stand on their own even without the lack of a truly cohesive overarching character arc.
I think we talked kind of too about how Life of Brian is almost a full movie, basically like a full movie with a narrative and everything. Holy Grail is like a mix. And Meaning of Life is like just straight sketches.
Holy Grail is a movie that goes until it stops, which is very Monty Python. That's kind of how the show was. It's just like, no, we don't need a punchline. It just ends.
It feels less like a cohesive movie, though.
Yeah. Yes.
But I mean, that's what I mean. I think we go from full cohesive movie, so-so, and then Meaning of Life like is just an extended episode of the show.
Ross P.M. Weigel writes, Brendan, he says... He writes, Dear Brendan.
Okay, it's just to me.
Not me.
Okay, well, you shut the fuck up then. Don't answer this comment.
Dear Brendan, I feel like the only Meaning of Life stand here. That one has such great songs and so many great characters. It's also a bit more of a sketch style movie, which I think fits their shtick best.
Well, I can't do a Dr. Ruth impression, but I will say that Dear Confused and Frustrated... sure. I mean, that's valid to me. Like, if you like a sketch... like, if they did Saturday Night Live, the movie, and it was just a sketch comedy movie, I'd be like, yeah, that makes sense. Of course, that's
I'm surprised they never have, like, a Kentucky Fried movie.
It would just be sketches, I guess. Yeah. Although that might be fun.
Film sketches would be, I mean,
alumni.
Well, you think about like how they do those film sketches right now. But we can't talk about SNL. Oh, we're not fucking around. All right.
Okay.
Next comment. This is a long one.
Okay. Kelly Shea says, okay, two things. And one we talked about, actually, Jason. Number one, in the biggest dickest scene, the guards were apparently just like folks who the pythons asked if they wanted to be in a movie. Their only instruction was that they couldn't laugh. So all that suppressed laughter during Michael Palin's whole bit was real. Number two, my favorite memory of watching this movie is from Easter 1998. We got home from church and my dad's sister, brother, and I decided to watch this. My mom, who's not much of a Monty Python fan, walked in for a moment, saw what we were watching, sighed, shook her head, said, "You're all going to hell," and walked out. I was eight. P.S. I'm Jewish now, so take that, Mom.
Kelly Shea, that sounds like an Irish name.
I
hope you're Irish because that sounds like something an Irish would happen in an Irish family. Mother just saying, "Oh, you're all going to hell.
You're all going to hell." It's like that story about Alec Baldwin's brother saying, "Everyone in this restaurant is going to hell."
Yeah. Steven, I assume. Yeah, Billy.
No.
Billy wouldn't do that.
Billy's okay, I think.
Billy's
right?
All right.
Is Billy the okay one?
He seems fine.
Yeah. Daniel.
Daniel's a bit of a like, I'm a mobster.
Wait, the one
or
in...
Or wait, is it Billy?
The one in... No, but I think Billy was in Next of Kin. I think he's the dicey one, too.
All right, enough Baldwin talk. We can't be fucking around.
Okay.
All right, next comment from
Wait, where's James Baldwin fall?
That's a good question. But we'll talk about that later.
We got a... Big comment here.
Big comment. Sharon Harwat, our serial commenter.
She watched it.
Number one. Yes, she watched this movie. Thank you, Sharon. That's awesome. So she says, I rewatch it all the way through again. Sharon says, I rewatched it all the way through again. And here are my thoughts in no particular order. Notes on the life of Brian, Sharon says. The first time I remember hearing about this movie was when one of the pythons was on the Graham Norton show and brought up how controversial the movie was. Was the controversy in any way connected to the Satanic Panic? I think it was a predecessor of the Satanic Panic, Sharon, because I think that really kicked up in the 80s. Now, certainly, later on, maybe.
I'm glad you're mentioning this because I don't know anything about this.
What little I know. And Sharon, get me here. You got to get me here, Sharon. I'm not an expert. But I think that was in the 80s. But good theory.
It's also a pretty good little horror movie, so you should check it out.
Absolutely.
You don't even know what I'm talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about. All right, next one. That gag at the end of the opening credits where the angel gets shot and stops singing is quite good. Oh, I love that. I love a good sniper shot. The blessed are the meek joke is great, especially Big Nose's wife's comment about how nice that is for them. Oh, isn't that nice? I think if I watched this with an audience, I would find it a lot funnier. Well, yeah, understandably. That's true of any movie. I'm disappointed that I've never actually got to see this with an audience, but they've never done it as a midnight movie here, unfortunately.
Closest I came to that was the Monty Python live show at the theater.
Oh, that would have been good.
Yeah.
The scene with Pontius Pilate is the funniest part so far. Okay, Sharon. I don't know if I agree with that, but he's pretty funny. I looked down for 1 second and now there are aliens.
Yes! That was almost my
That's
note.
How that's supposed to work.
Yeah.
Centurion Guard says, you're weird and weirdo. This is hilarious. Yeah, I agree. John Cleese saying somebody's weird is great. Graham Chapman trying to preach while a man haggles about a cord is my kind of joke. Also, him trying to tell a story but constantly being interrupted about unimportant details reminds me a lot of my mom. And that's how Brendan and I often converse. I want to make sure he knows all these
stream of
details.
Consciousness.
Absolutely. All these comments on how Christianity has many different branches and interpretations of the Bible still hold up really well. See, blessed are the cheesemakers. I have seen more of these guys naked than I care to see. Yeah, I've seen at least three of their penises.
Sharon, not
say.
A fan of the filmed penises here.
Oh, I guess yes. I was going to say, she's not... Oh, but then she says, none I care to see. Well, yeah, sure. But Graham Chapman was gay, so it's not like he'd have a chance anyways. Graham's Hail Caesar is perfect. Agreed. The ending is by far the best part. Not the funniest, not the best part. No wonder this song got put into Spamalot. I didn't know that. Weird.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure there is a musical version of this called He's Not the Messiah, He's a Naughty Boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess they put it in there too. I don't know a lot about Spamalot, to be
honest
with you.
No, well, it's just I don't know that it's available to see outside of a Broadway theater.
All right, Jason. Sally Louise Grant says, this is easily the movie I've seen most in my life. It's my dad's favorite, and I probably knew quotes from it before I even saw it. There are so many great jokes that you find on a repeated watching, and if someone says could be worse, I'm saying could be stabbed, and you can watch it at both Christmas and Easter.
That's true. Well, it's good any time of the year, really. But yes, Christmas and Easter, your parents want to watch It's a Wonderful Life. That's a good option. It's a great movie.
Great movie. That you saw for the first time recently?
I saw it for the first time all the way through this year.
I mean, I only watched it a couple of years ago, so we're good.
But, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, there's a reason people love it. But we're not talking about It's a Wonderful Life. We got to get this going. We got one more comment, Brendan. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Tim LaRosa. Tim is a guy who wears a suit, but without a tie and his sleeves rolled up.
Oh, cool. So he's like Richard Branson.
That's what I picture.
Does he have shorts?
Yeah, exactly. He's like Richard Branson. He could hang out with Richard Branson and nobody would think it was weird.
But Richard Branson would be like, lose the dress shirt, pal.
Well, Richard Branson would be like, well, no, you're I'm the alpha here. And Tim would be like, you got it, Dick. So Tim, sorry, Tim. Tim says, I love it with all my heart, but I think the best one is The Meaning of Life. The Meaning of Life captures everything that made the TV show so deliciously insane and expands it into a movie level of production and skill. It also lets you know from the start that it gives zero fucks and is going to do whatever it wants to do. And it does, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, Meaning of Life. That is such a fun movie.
It is a fun movie.
Mr. Creosote. He explodes.
I think bottom line, though, I'm still with Life of Brian being a lot of good points for every one of those movies.
Yes.
But I still think Life of Brian is the one that goes on the list.
Final word. If you like Monty Python, you can watch all of them, including In Now for Something Completely Different. If you haven't actually seen the Monty Python TV show, it is worth a watch to see In Now for Something Completely Different. And if you have seen the Monty Python TV show, it is kind of cool to see those sketches done again in a different form on film. And it's also a good primer. But yeah, all the Monty Python movies are good. Watch them all. But if for some reason your mom or your pastor has a gun to your head and says you can only watch one, then pick Life of Brian.
Yeah. You know that situation that you often find yourselves in when your pastor pulls out a gun on you in the middle of a sermon?
Says, you can only watch one movie this week. What's it going to be, boy?
I swear to God, I will blow your brains out.
If you say more than one movie, I will kill you.
Wow, I never thought we would get religious on this show. What am I talking about? That's like every week.
Yeah.
Jason, our last thing we do here just to wrap this up is we compare this, obviously, to the American Film Institute Top 100. This movie, Life of Brian, is number 28 on the BFI Top 100. Number 28 on the AFI Top 100 is All About Eve, which you have not seen.
Nope.
So you give the win to Life of Brian by default.
By default.
I have seen All About Eve, and honestly, that is one of my favorite movies. One of my favorite movies on the AFI Top 100. It's up there.
All right, like, folks, can we just take a quick side note here? All right, All About Eve, I'm sure it's great. Whatever. Fuck you. But are we just but a quick note. If we were talking about the best 100 movies that were released between 1998 and 2003, I would have seen them all. Okay? So don't pretend that I'm some neophyte that hasn't seen some fucking movies in my day. I've seen Collateral Damage, okay? I have seen Bring It On, okay? Opening night, I was there at Bring It On. So don't you judge me, Brendan, for not seeing All About Fucking Eve, okay?
But have you, all so, right, so babe? So what you're saying is you've seen All About Steve.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, great movie.
You might want to take that back after you watch it. Yeah, so All About Eve is a wonderful, wonderful movie, and I'm just saying this because I'm going to say that Life of Brian is obviously, it's taking the spot, but I can't stress this enough. If anyone out there has not seen All About Eve, please see All About Eve. It is like Betty Davis at her best.
So what you're saying is I should see All About Eve.
You should, at her bestie Davis.
All right, no more fucking around. We gotta move on.
All right, we got to talk about this week's film. We have to talk about The Railway Children. Yes, that music can only mean one thing, Jason.
Yes, sir.
It means that we are going from our comments section to our main movie discussion.
Yes, sir.
Otherwise, you wouldn't know what that music means because nobody knows what that music means.
No,
but it is the theme song to this week's film that we are talking about, number 66 on the BFI Top 100, called
The Railway Children.
Yeah.
All right.
One thing I want to say right away, Jason, no matter how we feel about this movie, at the end of the day, or only at the end of a couple hours. I mean, we're not going to be here for a whole day.
No, certainly not.
I felt a little deceived at the beginning of this at this film.
Now, why would you feel deceived, Brendan?
Well, as you and I watched the opening credits and we heard the lovely theme, we did start off by zooming in on this like music box and then seeing like an animated dove.
Yeah.
And I thought we were going to get a whole animated opening sequence, so I was a little let down.
So you were thinking like you wanted like a Pink Panther style, like entire animated show opening.
Yeah, Fritz the Cat.
That's the whole movie.
Oh, okay. I thought it was only 3 minutes. I thought that was a long opening credit sequence. Yeah. I was like, wait, when does the feature start? Are these cats fucking?
That's what they should have done. They shouldn't have had any title until the very end of the movie when it would just like flash on the screen. Fritz the cat. And
then the movie's like, it's padded with opening credit shit. Well, we are talking about the Railway Children. It is number 66, and it's also another movie which we had no idea.
No.
About what it is.
I saw Railway Children, and I thought, oh, so this is going to be like some kitchen sink drama about some homeless children that live on the railway and have to make do, and that there's a kindly seeming man that picks them up, and then it breaks bad, and they got to escape. And
if you go with that route, you have one of the children who's just like a little bit older than everyone else that just looks to the camera, and it's just like, they call me a railway child. One of the railway children, but no one can define who I am. Whatever they say I am, I'm not. I guess that's a little bit Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, but you know.
If I could see these people, if they think I'm a railway child, I'd line them all up against the wall and give them a right big wallop.
Railway children?
Railway children for life!
I'll say when I'm a railway children.
But that's not what this movie is at all.
We get back up, Mr. Wayne. Okay, yeah, no, it's not.
No, it is not. This movie is a, I guess you could call it a family picture, a nostalgia picture, a comedy, a heartwarming sort of thing. Yeah,
in the same vein as like maybe like Goodbye, Mr. Chips was more of a family film.
For sure. Set in 1905.
Yeah, 1905.
Edwardian England.
And also, it kind of has the look of The Go-Between, even if the movie is nothing like The Go-Between.
Yeah, it's got that, it like The Go-Between.
Same year,
like,
1970, same year.
Yeah, like The Go-Between, like Chariots of Fire. It's got a real pastoral, green feel to it. It's a really nice looking movie.
It's a beautiful
very
aesthetic.
Colorful, very colorful and very evocative. And you know, obviously you're, 1970, if you were, 10 years old in 1905, that would mean in 1970, you were 75 years old.
Mm.
So this nostalgic picture for a specific, I guess, group of people, but you know, and also one of those novel translations. And this is very much in the trope of a rich family gets quote unquote poor, and so they have to move to the country. And I feel like we've seen that otherwise. Didn't that sort of happen in
Sense and Sensibility?
Sense and Sensibility, yeah.
I feel like here, though, you really get the sense they're not well off. Because, no. I mean, we literally have one of the children stealing coal just so that his mother cannot die.
Yes, they're poor, certainly, but they, at the end of the day, at the end of the very first day, they still have a servant working for them.
But I don't know that servant is even making that much money.
No, certainly not. It's a small town. Yeah. And they have a very nice house that is kind of ratty when they get there, but they make do.
They're living in a small town.
Like, that's like they're poor, but they walk out their front door and they've got this amazing view of like English countryside, rolling hills and stuff. It's fucking gorgeous.
It is. So yeah, this movie is about a bunch of superheroes. They're called the Railway Children.
Yes.
I mean, kind of.
Peter has the power of the locomotive. Phyllis has the power of the caboose. And Bobby is every car in between, baby. When we start out this movie, Brendan, life's good, man. They're living in the city. They're having a fucking classic style Christmas with all the fixins. You know, they're living their best lives because Daddy works for the Foreign Office. Now, I did not know this initially, which made the rest of the movie just a little bit confusing to me, because at the very beginning we see a box with his name on it, and then it says Foreign Office. So I thought he was just a businessman or something for most of the movie. So I was very confused when we get to the main plot point of this film.
Mm-hmm. Well, because it all goes very well, and then so we have three children. We should note,
yes, the three
Bobby
children.
Bobby is played by we didn't even list the cast. Bobby is played by Jenny Agutter.
Interesting, two interesting facts. One, Jenny Agutter, of course, shows up in a later remake
and American Werewolf in London.
And two, I'm currently watching a science fiction television program called The Expanse, and in the second season, which I'm watching, there was a Marine introduced, and her name is Roberta, and also goes by Bobby. So I mean, it has nothing to do with this, but I wanted to mention that fact and also promote The Expanse because it's a fantastic
direct
show.
Reference.
Yeah, to this. I can see the writers of The Expanse, the two guys that go by James S.A. Corey. Yeah, they must have seen The Railway Children and thought, Roberta, that's a good name for a Martian Marine. We have Bobby. Roberta, who's Bobby.
Yep. We have Phyllis.
Yes.
Who's the middle child. And yes. We have Peter, the youngest one. Funny thing about Phyllis.
Yeah.
The actress Sally Thompson, which I did not know.
No clue.
She is 20 years old playing an 11-year-old.
I know.
Convincingly.
It's crazy. It's ridiculous because she's, yeah, she, I, until I read that, I was like, are you fucking serious? Like, she does not give the impression that she's that old at all.
So I looked back a little bit after I read that and I was just like, okay, like if I really look, maybe. And they do kind of position her. I noticed a lot of times she's like clearly lower in the frame.
Yeah.
To make her look shorter. And she has a very childlike face. So, yeah. I mean, I never... Did you know that actually... We might as well get into this now.
Sure.
On the set of this movie, nobody knew she was 20. So, like, obviously the people who hired her had to know. But she was a smoker. And they were like, you can't be seen smoking. You can't be seen drinking. Her contract basically forbid her to reveal her true age.
Which is weird because, like, what do you think would happen if you revealed her true age? Would that...
I think she was just worried that she'd get fired.
I mean, certainly in 60s Britain, we can imagine that there were like moral contracts, especially when it came to working with women.
Yeah. Yeah, and then again, Jenny Agutter, 17 years old, playing her older sister. Mm, so I think that's funny. You mentioned too, before we even get into this really, Jenny Agutter, the interesting thing about her is that when they did the remake, she played... the mother character.
Yeah, in the 2000 BBC, I think it's BBC remake of the, which I'm sure we'll probably watch at some point. Maybe. No? No, you don't
probably
want to watch
not. Probably okay. not. We got a lot on the, we got
that's
a
true.
The
we
plate.
Do have a lot of remakes of better movies. Maybe.
Oh. Well, Jason, this movie is directed by Lionel Jeffries.
Interestingly, also, Lionel, a name of a train company, I believe.
Oh. He
makes toys. Lionel Trains.
So. I want to round out the cast before we talk about that opening scene that you were mentioning. So Sally Thompson, we got that. It's Phyllis. Gary Warren is Peter. Dinah Sheridan is their mother, Mrs. Waterbury. Bernard Cribbins as Albert Perks. He's
still alive.
Still alive. William Mervin as old gentleman.
Mm.
We know who that is.
By the way, sounded very much like Emperor Palpatine.
Might have been. Might have been a pseudonym. Ian Cuthbertson as their father. And
wait, was Ian Cuthbertson the ghost of Christmas Present in Scrooge?
I don't remember.
As I know that name does sound familiar.
I think maybe.
Maybe.
Yes. We'll just say yes.
Okay.
Or that might have been my impression of...
Daniel Bryan?
No. Who's that guy who, like, bit people in the butt? Sportscaster?
Marv Albert?
There we go.
Oh, yes!
Yeah.
Yes, Marv Albert!
Sometimes when I bite them on the anus, I get a huge erection! Yes!
Yeah, that's one of those stories. I got to look into that because I always wondered, like... Was that, were we discussing with the story because of his perversions, or were we discussing the stories because something dark happened? Like, I don't know, was there a sexual assault, perhaps?
I think it was consensual, as far as I know, but don't quote me on that, because if it wasn't, I don't want to be a monster.
Because, yeah, if it was just a question of his weirdness, it's like, who the fuck are we to judge in 2021 how somebody lives their sexual life?
I mean, it didn't destroy his career, so whatever.
Is he still on TV?
No, he was for a while after that,
yeah,
I think.
That's true.
Anyway, fuck.
We're not talking about Marv Albert.
So talk about what happens at... So everyone's living the idyllic life.
Yes, it's wonderful. It's perfect. It's the perfect Edwardian existence.
But then a train explodes.
A train explodes.
Their toy train explodes.
Yeah,
and that's what signals it. The dog takes off, and as the narrator tells us, we never see them again.
Yeah, the dog just fucking takes off and is gone.
Becomes the littlest hobo.
Maybe tomorrow I want to settle down.
Until tomorrow, I'm just running from exploding trains.
As you do, yeah. Well, a smart dog. No, so the train explodes, and that's when everything changed. Things starts to go bad. At their Christmas dinner, two shadowy gentlemen show up to the house to speak to the father, and they hear yelling, but not in distinct things, and they find out that their daddy has to leave with these gentlemen.
Yeah, and this is this right away kind of establishes that we are the children. We are taking their point of view because we don't know anything outside of what they know.
Well, I had their point of view except for the fact I didn't know what he did for a living.
Yeah,
they knew
yeah.
what he did for a living.
But I just mean, like, in terms of how they framed this scene, like, let's just take a listen to the whole, like, arrest that happened. Or, well, I spoiled it, but it's an arrest.
It's an arrest.
As we find out later. But I didn't know.
I was like, are these mobsters? Like, what's going on?
That's what I thought.
Because the guy says, like, I don't like doing a job like this on Christmas.
Yeah, and we don't, and I thought they were just going to get robbed.
Yeah. So or murdered.
Yeah. Oh, my God, can you imagine? That's when our whole family was murdered. Guess what? The rest of the movie were ghosts.
Hey, everybody, I'm in this movie now.
And then they go, oh, no.
You know what? I need a movie to get into, so I'm going to be in this movie as a producer.
I'm gonna go through a woman's panties on the bus.
No, get out of here, you. Go back to where you're supposed to be. Which is prison, I'm pretty sure.
Back to hell I go.
You're not dead yet. Go back to prison. All right.
I'm enjoying prison. We hate
you. Get out of here.
Hey, oh. we hate hearing you say that. Stop saying you like prison.
I really like your work, but your later work is maybe the problem.
Let's listen to the clip.
All right.
What a wreck.
Is there any hope?
Hope? Of course it'll want hope. And a new valve. I tell you what, I'll give up Saturday afternoon to it. Yes, and you can help me.
Oh. I hate doing a job like this, especially at Christmas.
Yeah.
Who on earth's that? An Englishman's house is his castle, but I do wish they'd build them with moats and drawbridges, eh? Come in. Yes?
Please, sir, there are two gentlemen wish to see you. I showed them into the study, sir. I hope that was all right.
Excuse
me. I wish we did have a moat and drawbridge. Then if we didn't want anyone to...
I've never heard of it. Well? Who?
Why is Daddy shouting?
I don't know, dear. Come in. Yes, Ruth? What is it?
Please, ma'am, the master wants you to just step into the study.
Yeah, so what I think is interesting there, like I said, it's the POV of the kids because we just hear kind of muffled yelling behind the door. We see the kids like kind of sneaking around. We don't really know what's happening. We kind of see the world, at least through Bobby's eyes. Bobby, the lead.
Yes.
Like Jenny Agutter, who is the older sister, but again, played by a younger actress than the 11-year-old.
I think they get that.
Yeah. I can't reiterate that enough.
Yes.
But yeah, so that's what happens. So we find out that he does get arrested. And because of this, like in Sense and Sensibility, not in the sense where he gets arrested, but in the sense where the father leaves the film through death or otherwise, they have to move to Yorkshire. And like you said, they
always go to Yorkshire. It must be cheap land in Yorkshire. Now, I feel like Yorkshire people are very nice and it would be a great place to live, but
they just want to go and get a Kestrel.
That's right.
Yeah. But they do. And Jason, I realize we just played a clip, but I would be remiss if I didn't play this because they go to Yorkshire and they get like a guide to go to Yorkshire. And I just had to play this because I think it's so...
I forgot about this guy. He stood out so much, and then it was like, oh, what's his deal? And then we never see him again.
He's just like, he's basically a cartoon character in the middle of this movie.
It's like, so I feel like something from like a Mel Brooks movie or something to some extent. Like, there would definitely be a character like that.
So much so, Jason, that like when this character came up, I thought, okay, this is the tone for the rest of the movie. Like, you'll hear in this clip the tone, a very distinct tone, and I said, okay, this is the movie. Yeah. But I was completely wrong.
No.
Excuse me, we want to go to the house on the hill, the Three Chimneys. Do you know the way?
I dare say.
Well, will you show us?
I dare say. Hi-ho.
Oh, Phil, is you all right?
Yes.
Can't we put just one box on your cart?
You asked me to show you the way. Nothing was said about boxes.
Never mind, darlings. It's only a few more yards.
Whoa.
I wonder why she didn't leave the lights on.
Who's she?
Mrs. Viney, the woman I engaged to clean the place and to get the supper.
Expect Mrs. Viney's gone home. Your train was late, see?
But she's got the key. What do we do?
Should have left that under the doorstep. We all do hereabouts.
Well, you might have said so.
You never asked, did you? Nothing was said about a door key.
May I borrow your lamp, please?
I dare say.
If you say I dare say once more, I shall have hysterics, I dare say.
It's a fun little scene. But again, like, it kind of goes from being kind of absurd. Actually, up to that point, there's a few absurdist kind of moments with the maid that they pour a bucket of water on and everything, and get her fired.
Yeah,
by the way.
Well, but that's the thing. But let's talk about that briefly. Okay. That scene where the maid comes in and the water gets dumped on her.
It's a different movie, Jason.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The water gets dumped on her, and she obviously is pissed off by this, and the kid's back up into the corridor, and she's coming up to them, and it's such a cartoonish, like, scene that my modern comedy mind was like, she's gonna, because it was so overdramatic and whatever, she, like, raises her hand, and the music swells, and they're, like, backing into the corner, and I thought it was gonna be something where she's gonna be like, oh, that's all right, masters. Totally... You know,
me too, 100%. Yeah. I thought she was going to raise her hand up in the air and then just start slapping her knee and be like, oh, good show.
Yeah, but instead she actually fucking slaps him. And then immediately gets fired because mama don't play that.
And I'm sure this was not the intention of the film, maybe. But like in a modern film, that would also be a joke. Because the joke would be like you would be expecting her to do the fake out.
Yeah, do some fake out.
But then she smacks them. And it's like that would be funny. But in this movie, I don't know if they were that meta.
It felt more shocking just because the tone was so comedic in the lead up to it. And then she hits this little boy.
Who probably didn't set it up for the most part.
Yeah.
Probably the two girls. But yeah, anyway, so there's that scene, there's that. There's little moments in the first third, and maybe this is an intentional way to kind of lure you into this world and then be like, and then take it away. It's just kind of like, no, now it's kind of stripped away from the movie. Now you're kind of, I'm not saying this is like a gritty movie by any stretch of the imagination.
No, this movie's quite positive because, you know, for being poor, they do pretty well.
They do pretty well. But I mean, it is a bit of a dire start because we could see that the mother gets sick right away.
Yes.
And of course, my movie watching brain,
I'm like,
she's going to die.
It's 1905. It's a British movie. She's sick. It's a mother. It's a family film. Yeah. She's going to fucking die.
She's going to die. And they're going to go live with the fucking train conductor.
They're going to go live on the railway. They're going to be hopping from train to train.
The railway children. That's just right. Three little homeless children solving mysteries.
And occasionally getting a bite to eat from Mr. Perk, who takes pity on them.
Mr. Perk, the train
Mr. Perks.
Conductor.
Mr. Perks. Perks.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's perks to getting to know Mr. Perks, eh?
That's right, yeah. Well, let's mention him briefly. He is the...
Well, we should... Before we do that, just want to say, this movie is... The plot is very loose.
Yeah.
It's essentially these kids living in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
And kind of their experiences and with other people.
Apparently, this movie is quite close to the novel. The screenwriter, I guess, was very, and director, Lionel, was insistent on kind of just keeping the tone of the book. And so the way it kind of plays out is in a series of almost vignettes.
Basically.
In a sense that we see these little mini stories of their life. And the first, you know, first one being, what was the first one? Like getting to know Mr. Perks, maybe?
Well, I mean, the first thing they do is kind of go watch the trains go by, and they're waving
old
gentleman.
Yeah, right. So the first story is you know, they get there, and then the first story is the mom gets sick, so they want to help her. Doctor comes by, recommends like a list of stuff that they should have to keep her happy, including brandy, of course.
Yeah, of course.
But they can't afford it because they don't have any money, so they flag down the train and give a note to the rich guy who's sitting in the back that's been waving at them that they need some help. And, of course, he's a good old rich man, so he sends them a hamper of shit, like a whole hamper full of stuff.
And can we listen to the mom's reaction to that?
Yes. Now, I related to this so much because this is kind of how I was raised and the attitude that I've had my whole life and many people of lower means that I know where there's a certain pride. And this is very prevalent, I believe, in British culture, too. Mm-hmm. When you're poor, the idea of taking any charity is absolutely just out of your mind. You can't bear that, the hit to your pride that would take. So.
Exactly.
It's quite true that we're poor, but we shall have enough to live on just so long as I have ideas for stories. But you mustn't go about telling people of our affairs. It isn't right. And you must never, never, never ask strangers to give you things. Always remember that.
Yes, sir.
I shall write to your old gentleman. I shall tell him that I didn't approve. Oh, I shall thank him, too, of course, for his kindness. But it's you that I don't approve of, not the old gentleman. He's been extremely kind. You can give my letter to your Mr. Perks to give to him. And he won't say any more about it.
Isn't she marvelous when she's angry?
There's some real funny lines in this movie, and that's one of them, just where it feels like a really modern like kind of thing where the kid's just like, oh, she's marvelous when she's angry.
You know what? I When I heard that line, though, I was like, he's into her.
He's into his mom.
He's into his mom a little bit. It just, the delivery was what got me. I know it's not intentional, but, you know.
But I think that's also kind of comes through with this. There's a positivity to this movie. Like, there's no tension, really, between the kids and their mom. Like, they all love each other. They're nice to each other. I would assume that they must fight, but we never see it.
That felt fresh a little bit. That there was nothing, like, she wasn't, like, a tyrant.
Yeah.
Even we get a kind of a tyrant character. Like, we mentioned the maid that gets water dumped on her head, and immediately as soon as that happened, the mom is like, you're fired.
Yeah,
like, because she slapped her boy around, right?
Yeah, it's like in Small Faces when mom steps in front of the brother that's gonna fucking stab them, you know. She's a mama bear kind of mom.
Exactly,
doesn't take shit.
Yeah, no favoritism or anything. The mom loves all of them. But yeah, so she has a certain pride. And like you said, it's a certain pride you have when you don't want people to get the sense that you're like, I don't want people to think that I can't afford this or can't do this.
Or you don't want people to think that you're taking advantage of their generosity.
Right, right, exactly.
Absolutely. And that's the biggest thing, is you don't want to be seen as some sort of leech or you know, sucker of blood that isn't a leech, but still sucks blood.
Makes a lot more sense why Robin Leach is his name.
Oh, God, that guy. Ooh.
I don't know why. I'll come to your house and I'll drain all your energy and life.
Because you're not rich like all the people that I respect.
Jason, he had a paycheck for a while. I just want
He had a lot. He had a lot of paychecks. He was doing real well.
Okay, so yeah, that's like the first story, basically, the first vignette. And she's very, she's kind of upset about it. But I mean, I think ultimately she does take it. But she's like, you know, don't do this again. Don't go to that old, whoever it is. I don't want you going to him. I don't want you to go ask him for anything else.
Because we have to remember, they're not completely without means. Mom is writing stories. I don't know that it's ever expounded upon. But we have to remember that back in 1905, that was a world where there were a lot of like literary magazines where you could publish stories. And that, you know, it was like through the early 20th century before, you know, TV and stuff. Like, that was how people got like their kind of pulp entertainment.
What I think is interesting about that whole storyline too is that later on in the movie, they save a young man. Because the young man trips. Well, they're doing a paper chase. Which
a young
I
man,
never
by
knew,
the way.
I never knew what that was, by the way.
Me neither. I looked it up. I mean, I figured out from context what it was, and then I looked it up and was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'd never heard of that before. By the way, this young kid kind of reminds me of the young guy on The Expanse that's the Tom Jane's little buddy.
He kind of reminded me of Gregory from Gregory's Girl.
Oh, a little more swarthy, though.
Yeah. But, yeah, so I guess a paper chase, just to explain it, is you're just kind of dropping little pieces of paper and people are chasing you.
In an urban environment, apparently, based on what I read on Wikipedia, it says that you would use chalk and, like, mark, like, corners and things as you go by.
Okay.
Which is a little different because the part of the thing about the paper chase using the paper is that it's kind of, because it's supposed to represent, because the person dropping the paper is supposed to represent a hare. And you're hunting the hare.
Okay.
And so you drop the paper. But the idea is that dropping the paper, the wind can blow it away. So it's like scent.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to keep the scent. But sometimes the scent gets blown away and you can fuck over your run.
So when that whole thing happens, this very clumsy boy falls on the train tracks and nearly gets hit by a train.
Yes.
But then they kind of like nurse him back to health. So the connection I was going to make to the thing earlier with the whole story, so you're talking about how she writes stories, because remember at this point we find out that the old man they've been waving to on the train is this injured guy's grandfather?
Yes. This old man, which we never know his name.
No, we never know his name.
But it's clear he's some rich mucky muck.
Yeah. And he's credited as old man.
Yeah.
But he tells the mother, you know, you can basically care for my grandson until he's better at my hospital. And the only patient at the hospital is him, and you're the only nurse. Basically just saying, I'm going to pay you to look after
him. It's an excuse that I can give you money so you don't have your pride hurt.
Right. But then she says something about, and then he says something about, like, you know, maybe you could become a nurse and then you won't even have to write. And they have that, it's kind of a progressive moment though, because she says, well, I really like to write. Like, I want to continue
writing.
And
then he goes, well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Like a threat.
We'll see how you feel.
Yeah. Maybe being a nurse is more fulfilling.
But I like how she says, like, no, I don't do it because I need to. I mean, I do need to, but I also enjoy it.
Yeah.
And I have agency.
That's right. You're your own damn person, Mom.
I'm every woman. I also like how when that kid finally does get nursed back to health, and he's on the train, and Bobby has like a kind of a moment with him, like she holds his hand as he leaves. Phyllis says something along the lines of like, "Oh, well, now they've got to get married."
Yeah.
Like, you know what? In a British movie in 1970, probably.
And back in 1905, it'd be more likely that that would be a thing that, yes. Oh, look, they're holding hands. They should be together.
I do like that they don't fully go with that romance angle, though, because I was like, oh, really? Come on.
that's the thing. It wouldn't really do this movie good. Like I said, this movie's kind of a family film and doesn't really need a romance angle, I would say.
It is. And did you know also that the director was like, he basically read it and said, my personality is so different from the quiet romance of this story. But he said he just wanted to do something. He said that at the time in 1970, there were hardly any movies made for everyone. He wanted to do something that was like children, you know, adults, older adults. He just wanted to make something that would appeal to everyone.
Yeah.
And he said he thought this could be the one. He bought the option on this movie for £300.
Wow.
And he wrote a screenplay. And like you said, he stayed very close to it. He basically said, like, I guess he was so young at the time and green that he said, I know there was probably bets among the technical staff as to how long I was going to last as a director. He took a big calculated risk because the turn of 1970, things are getting more... like nothing's really quaint anymore in the industry. Like the movies that are like more quaint, like this and The Go-Between, still kind of have an edge to them. Like The Go-Between has a little bit of a sinister edge to it.
Yeah, well, because it's two people having illicit relations
and a death at the end of the movie, right? Yeah. I mean, like Alan Bates, is it Alan Bates?
Alan Bates.
I think it's Alan Bates. Women in Love. We don't do research here. I believe it is Alan Bates in the movie. Anyway, thought that was interesting that the director basically took on something he wasn't completely comfortable doing, but he thought it would be fun.
Well, it probably made him a better filmmaker in the process, I'd say.
He said he wanted to make it as close to a Victorian documentary as possible. Again, guys, I know you're like, well, they're just kind of jumping around, but that's kind of what this movie is. Yeah. It just kind of jumps around to different vignettes.
I wouldn't say there's an overall plot. The overall plot is kind of the fate of the father and the fact that they're in the country and they're waiting for some resolution on him because the kids don't know what happened. The mom has not told them the specifics.
And because mom has not told them, mom has not told us watching the movie, which again, I think is really, that's cool that it's like that because...
This movie is clearly from Roberta's perspective, so we're getting it from her. Because when we find out through her.
And you can imagine watching this movie as a kid in 1970. I mean, people back then had more attention spans, so I think they were able to watch this okay. Mm. But like, imagine watching this as a kid in 1970. You don't know either. Like, if the kid doesn't know watching the movie, then we shouldn't know.
Yeah.
Like, it really is for everyone.
Yeah. Exactly, but there's
it's a four quadrant movie, Jason.
Some deep history references in there,
Jason. I wanted to talk about this particular part with you quite a bit because I know you're a history guy.
Sure.
There is a whole scene here where they find a very upset or confused Russian man. By the train one day, and the train station is kind of where everything kind of comes together. Like everyone kind of meets at the train station.
That's the center of the town, and Mr. Perks is the beating heart of that.
Again, we will get to Mr. Perks, so we're not going to leave that out because he's one of the most interesting characters. Yeah. But they meet this Russian guy who's kind of confused and bewildered, and they figure out basically that he speaks French. So they're like, oh, our mother can speak French. Maybe we can find out, you know, what's going on. But so this is 1905, and we learn from the mother that he is an exiled writer in Russia.
Yes.
Because he wrote some not so nice things about the government. Let's just listen to the thing that she tells her kids about who this guy is.
Yeah.
And we're not going to open Google Chrome.
We're not going to go to FARC.
Do tell us about the Russian, Mom. I can't make a long story of it, darling, because I'm very tired. He's a very clever writer. But in Russia, one dare not say anything about the rich people doing wrong or what ought to be done for the poor. If one does, one is sent to prison. Well, he wrote a book about it all. And he was 3 years in a dungeon. No light, damp and dreadful. Then they took him out and they sent him to Siberia and he was condemned to stay there for life.
For life? For writing a book? That's stupid. Go on, Mama.
While he was at the mines, some friends got a message to him to say that his wife and children had escaped to England. And so after many adventures, he too escaped and came here to look for them.
Do you think he will find them?
Oh, I do hope so. I think, my darlings, in your prayers, you might ask God to show his pity upon all prisoners and captives.
To show his pity upon all prisoners and captives?
Yes, darling. On all prisoners and captives.
All right, so the first thing I got to say, so when this Russian writer first shows up on the train, he kind of collapses, they bring him in. they realize they're trying to figure out what he's speaking, and they figure out he can speak French, right? So she knows enough French, Roberta, that she tells him that, wait for mother. Mother speaks great French. She'll be able to talk to you and figure out what happened. And so they take him inside, whatever. They wait for the train to show up, and mom comes in. And so they've been going on about, like, mom's this great French speaker. She'll be able to help you out. Like, don't worry. She speaks French beautifully. And they get this all amped up. And she comes in, and the only thing she says to him in French for the entire movie is the equivalent of, like, who are you? And then he explains. She's like, oh, he's a Russian writer. And that's it.
I think they have a bigger conversation off screen, though.
Oh, sure, certainly. But, like, on screen, yeah. It's just, like, she literally says three words to him.
Well, that's Dinah Sheridan being like, I can't speak French.
So a little bit of history, I guess. Well, because this takes place in 1905. In 1905, Russia, which was at that point czarist.
Is this around the same time as, like, the Zhivago stuff?
No, that's later. This 1905 Zhivago stuff would be like 1917, 1918 when the revolution happened.
Okay, gotcha.
So this is pre-communist Russia. 1905 was the year of the Russo-Japanese War. Vince Russo in 1905 took on all of Japan, and they wouldn't put up with his bullshit, so he had, like, to go dormant for a while.
I'm not putting you on nitro, bro.
Bro, you can't be taking these Russian islands, bro. It's not for you. Now, I got a better idea. What if you had sex with a dead person?
Or you put friggin' Russia on a pole, bro.
Russia on a pole. You can't go wrong with Russia on a pole. Nobody will expect it, bro.
Hey, the tag team champions are going to be Buff Bagwell, Vladimir Putin's mother.
But yeah, the Russo-Japanese War in 1905 was a territorial war. You know, both countries had imperialist ambitions at the time, and I think Russia wanted a warm water port, and the Japanese were like, hey, no. And so they fought a war over a year or two. So that was the main, like, political thrust at the time. So that becomes interesting when we figure into the father, who is accused, we learn.
Being a spy.
Of being a spy and selling secrets. Now, this is Britain. Britain's not involved in the Russo-Japanese War. But you have to understand, Europe in 1905, in this Edwardian area, this was in the, you know, this was about 9 years before World War I. So this was when Europe was essentially a tinderbox. You had all these different competing dynasties, and I know we've talked about this shit before, but just to refresh, you had all these competing different monarchies that were shifting alliances and whatnot, and that's a good reason why this Russian guy speaks French, is because in those days, Russia and France, because Germany at some point in the 1800s had abandoned their alliance with Russia, Russia had kind of become friendly with France, and it became a thing in aristocratic Russia that if you were an upper-class person, you spoke French in addition to speaking Russian. So that's why he speaks French, because he's probably from that class. So
would he have been attacking, like escaping from?
Well, Tsarist Russia, much like later communist Russia, wasn't real big on criticizing the government in any way. Now, this writer in this movie is not a real guy. But
no.
The writer of the novel apparently was friends with a couple of Russian writers that had been exiled for various reasons, similarly, and sort of made a composite of them in this book. But, like, I'm more like, because that's the thing, when I was watching it, I was thinking of, like, Alexander Solzhenitsyn or Boris
Yeltsin,
not Karloff, or Yeltsin.
You're anticipating
Boris Pasternak.
You're anticipating my joke names now. Isn't Boris Pasternak the author of Dr. Zhivago?
Maybe, yeah, it might be. But yeah, guys like that wrote books that were, like, not cool in Russia. But clearly in Tsarist Russia it was similar. And in a lot of monarchies, the idea of criticizing the monarchy, come on, that's bullshit. So yeah, you've got a really interesting time here. And so for him to be accused of selling secrets in this era, like to the Germans or to whoever, that's a big deal. And there might be some root, there's some thought that there might be some root in this. Have you ever heard of something, Brendan, called the Dreyfus Affair?
Richard?
Nope.
No, I haven't.
So Dreyfus, Alfred Dreyfus, was a French officer in, like, the 1800s. But to his detriment in France, he was also a Jew. And he was accused of selling secrets to the enemy, to being a traitor. And there was this whole, like, big public show trial. There was a huge rise in anti-Semitism in Europe. They assumed that he had done this because he was Jewish. And that, you know, obviously because Jews had some plan to take over the world, and it was a big, big media thing. And he eventually was acquitted because there was no evidence that he had done this. And surprisingly, the man continued to serve in the French military, I think even through World War I. That's loyalty to your country, that you get stuck in that kind of fucking bullshit. But anyway, so the idea that he was accused of something he didn't do because of who he was, I don't know if this dude's supposed to be Jewish, I don't think so. But he's clearly accused of something he didn't do, and there has to be strings pulled and maneuvering done by rich old men to fix the problem.
Well, yeah, because they managed to track down his family. That's what he wants to do, right? He wants to find his family because we learned that they left first. Mm. They escaped because he told them to get out. Get out of my house. No, not like that. But he told them to get out while they can, and that he would follow. And then he managed to escape. But now, you know, he, like, where he is, no one speaks French really, except the mother who knows those three words.
Yeah.
And and yeah, he's just trying to find his family. And then they kind of, and they do, right? Because yeah, the old man,
he's a prominent writer, clearly. He's somebody that's known by the upper classes and the sorts of people that would know about writers, so that when they get in touch with the old man, he knows who he is.
Okay, so that makes it a little bit easier for me to digest, because yeah. At first I was like, like, it just seemed like a really big convenience that the old man on the train is like, well, I'm rich, so I clearly have the world's first phone book. So I have found your entire family, but that makes more sense.
That's the thing about the West, is that we have a much freer press here. So those books did get like smuggled out and published. And so the sorts of people that would read those books knew who he was. So it makes sense that an old rich guy would be able to help him out and maybe find his family for him.
So I think that's a really kind of interesting vignette.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you explained history, because now I know exactly what's going on. That's why we pay you.
That's right. That's why I love talking about history on this podcast. Actually, that was funny. My friend is listening to this for the first time, and his thing was like, you said to me, you really like talking about history on this. I'm like, yes, I do. And that was the first episode he's listening to.
Oh, just wait till he gets to Zulu and Bridge on the River Kwai.
Damn straight, man. We have lots of fun in those. We dig deep into the history of it.
Dig deep. Just like this one.
I'm like Dan Carlin, except I got no credibility.
Deep into the railway. Okay, and then the other vignette, of course, is Mr. Perks.
Mr. Perks. Let's talk about this man. He's wonderful. He's the... I don't know, like a railway manager or something? Like, he's clearly not the head guy. He does everything, but he makes reference to, like, a head guy, like a real railway manager, who at some point gets drunk in a pool hall and breaks his leg, so he has to take over.
He's like that guy that, like, the boss...
The unseen boss.
The unseen boss looks good. Well, no, I'm saying, like, the boss, the actual boss, looks good because Perks does all the work.
Yeah, exactly. He's clearly hardcore into his job. He makes sure, you know, he keeps those trains on time. He's a modern-day Mussolini. Well, actually, pre-Mussolini. Although Mussolini would have been alive in 1905. That was back when Mussolini was still a socialist, I imagine.
I don't believe Perks is a bad man like Benito Mussolini.
Certainly not. And I hope he was not hanged in the same way.
Not in the same way. but it was similar. We'll get into it next week.
But he's like a classic British archetype. He's a prideful man. He loves his job. He does his best for his family and doesn't like charity. You know, he wants to earn his way.
Yeah, exactly. That's the type of character he is. He played by Bernard Cribbins. Mm-hmm. That's the actor's name. He also is a guy, like you said, he's a prideful guy, but he's also a guy that, like, if he does something for someone else, he doesn't want them to feel like it's charity.
No,
either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's the thing, is that that's the thing about these sorts of lower class people and coming from that. It's, you know, you want to help everybody you can, but the idea of you getting help is hard to swallow.
I'm thinking specifically of the scene where he goes to visit the children and he's like, yeah, I found all these old magazines. Like, you know, they're whatever. They were collecting dust. I don't want them. Take them. Like, yeah,
exactly. You don't want to make it seem like you're like being charitable, but it's more just like, oh, I thought you might like them. Just they were going to throw them out anyways. Why don't you take them off my hands?
You kids like your magazines.
Yeah, you like pictures and stuff.
Yeah. There's probably some nude women in there.
Oh, there's some African titties in there.
Oh, wow. We just gave them a pile of National Geographics.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so I think he's a really interesting character. I do think.
Well, because he really likes those kids, and he tolerates their hanging around the radio station and radio station.
It's Mr. Perks here on K103 FM. Choo choo, chicka 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 hit. Wait, rolling in with the hits. Next stop, Prince.
Are you done?
Chicka chicka choo choo.
At the train station, they hang around, and he's happy to have them there. They don't cause no trouble. They don't cause no mind. Even though they're, like, holding up banners at the trains and getting them to stop at the station, you know, he doesn't seem to mind that.
Although he does seem to always be in a rush. He always seems like he has to be somewhere else.
Yeah, and that's the nature of the job with the trains. You want the trains to run on time, you got to be on the ball.
Like,
and
he's literally changing the tracks seconds before they arrive to make sure there's no crashes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Closing the gates and switching the tracks so the train can blast through.
And then he's delivering mail, Jason. He's also delivering packages.
He's doing everything. I think he's the only employee over there, pretty much, it seems.
I remember seeing one other person, but I'm sure that guy does jack shit.
Yeah, he just hangs
perks
out.
Around.
He hangs out and drinks in the break room with the doctor. The doctor, by the way, I forget what his name is, but he has the most wonderful chops. Beautiful chops.
Oh, yeah.
Chops I wish I could have had when I was in high school.
But, well, too fucking late now, bitch.
Yeah, it is. It is too late. And also, he's I love that at one point when the mother's sick, they go to fetch the doctor for the first time, and he's like laying on his lawn drinking out of a flask.
Yeah, he's just flat out on the lawn.
No, I'll bring the drunk doctor down and help my mom.
I mean, what else is a doctor going to do in that tiny of a town?
That's true. You know, you only have so much work in the run of a day, I suppose.
Can't someone just get cancer?
Although, interestingly, he's quite cutting edge where he has a sort of a club where the locals are part of. So I assume it's sort of an insurance type arrangement where they all pay in and then you get treated and don't have to pay extra because you've been paying into it, which is pretty cool. I mean that's at that time that was the sort of thing where if you wanted medical help you had to pay for it.
So speaking of perks, he back to perks for a second, he is a character who he also mentions in one scene that they talk about like his birthday because they really want to give back because he's been so nice to them.
They love the guy.
He delivered that package from the old man. He's given them these magazines, which I think that's later. But anyway, he's been so nice to them and courteous to them. And they're like, they really want to give back. And they asked him when his birthday is. And he basically finally breaks down and says, I'll be 42 on the 15th of the month.
He's 42. He's 5 years older than me. Now, I'm not saying I'm like the greatest looking person that ever lived. But I feel like I don't look nearly as old as this guy.
I don't think you look as old as you are, Jason.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. It's pretty good for smoking for 15 years or whatever it was.
Yeah. I mean, I figured you to be like around my age or a little younger.
Yeah, that's right. Damn it. 37, baby.
Yeah.
Including you.
What?
Including you.
Wait, so are we 13 and 14?
Yes, we are 13 and 14 years old.
No, that's 27. Our math is terrible. Yeah. We're little children doing this podcast.
We are...
18.
Sure.
You're 19, I'm 18.
That's right.
We're adults.
I buy you beer.
Yeah, that's pretty sick. Thanks, buddy. Don't say that on the air. But anyway, where were we going with that?
I don't know.
Perks, yes. So they finally decide, like, they want to give him something. And what they do is they go around, the kids go around the entire neighborhood. And what's funny is while they're doing this, some people are like, I don't want to give him a present.
Yeah, there's one guy that literally says, he's like, Perks, no, I hate him.
Which I'm like, what?
Why?
Why do you hate him?
What did he do to you, bud?
It's a funny little detail. Yeah. But, like, they go around and they get, like, presents from everyone. And they drop it off at Perks' house. And I do want to just play his reaction to this because it reminds me a lot of the mother.
I've got an all right all these years and no favors asked. I'm not going to begin these sort of charity goings on at my time of life. And don't you think it, Nell.
Oh, shush, Bert. Shut your silly tongue, for goodness sake. The all three of them's in the other room are listening to every word you speaks.
Right, I'll give them something to listen to. Spoke my mind to these before, I'll do it again. Come out. Come on, out. Out here, come on. No, not you lot. You stop in there. Sophie, look, put some pants on Benjamin. We've got company. Right, you can tell me what you mean by it. Have I ever complained to you of being short as you start this charity with me?
We thought you'd be so pleased, Mr. Perks. I'll never try and be kind to anyone else as long as I live. No, I won't. Not never.
Didn't mean any harm.
It isn't what you mean so much as what you does.
We thought you'd love it. We always have things on our birthdays.
Oh, aye, from your own relations. That's different.
No, not just our relations.
They're from all sorts of people in the village.
And who put them up to it, I'd like to know.
He did.
So you've been going round telling the neighbours that we can't make both ends meet. Well, now you've disgraced us as deep as you can in the neighborhood. You can just take that old pack of tricks back where it came from. I'm very much obliged, I'm sure. I don't doubt but what you meant it kind, but I'd rather not be acquainted with you any longer. It's all the same to you.
Look here. We'll go if you like. And you needn't be friends with us anymore if you don't want to. But before
we'll always be friends with you, even though you're nasty to us.
But before we go, do let us show you these labels that we brought to put on the things.
I don't want to see no labels except proper luggage labels in my own walk of life.
Please let Bobby show you the labels.
All right, go on.
So what we find after that is that they go through the labels and explain the nature of what these are. And these are gifts. These are not charity.
Yeah, this is not just them giving him stuff.
No, it's from people that clearly like and respect Perks.
Yeah.
And they say as much on these labels. And eventually he realizes that, oh no, this is because they like me. This is because they respect me. It's not because they think I'm needy.
No, and that does turn him around.
Yeah.
And I just think that scene with the mother scene earlier is like, it's symmetry, right?
Yeah.
They both feel pretty much the same way about that kind of thing.
It's that again, that deep pride you have.
To which I almost expected, like, I don't know, for some reason I thought in this movie it would have been interesting if they made Perks like a widower.
Hmm.
And maybe the father got sent off and he's like never coming back. Hmm. And you don't go for like the full romance between the mother and Perks, but it would have been interesting to have that connection.
Oh, I like you. Why don't you come back to me? I'll put the kids in the cupboard.
your old man ain't never coming back. He's going to Russia. What am I doing?
He's going to Russia. He is. He's going to write a book and get exiled.
Wait a second. It's coming full circle. Also, the interesting thing about Perks is he's played by Bernard Cribbins, but Lionel Jeffries was actually going to play the role himself at first.
Interesting.
But then he had this guy, Bernard Cribbins, audition, and he was like, I can't possibly play the role with this man right here.
You saw the guy that is right for it, and he was right for it.
Yeah, he said he loved his lovely, calm comedy.
Hmm.
Also, a little note too, Jason, at the time of filming this, there were very few heritage railways in Britain where they could actually film in. And they could only have one tunnel. They only had one tunnel provided. Which, of course, plays into a number of scenes. The tunnel is actually a lot shorter than it shows in the movie, so they had to cheat it. So, obviously, there's a lot of scenes where they cut to the front and cut to the back. And you know.
Because it seems very long in the movie.
Because
the idea that they can't see the kid when he's down in there, Jim or whatever his name is.
They basically made these like canvas covers to make the tunnel extended as well. But I think that was that's interesting that they didn't actually have that many tunnels. They're like, oh, how are we going to film this? They also have a little thing at the start of the credit sequence. I guess someone can be heard saying, thank you, Mr. Forbes.
Mm.
And that was literally just acknowledging the producer, Brian Forbes, who put the movie together.
Thanks, Brian.
I also want to mention that the novel was adapted for radio before this in 1943. Mm. It was on TV in 1951. It was adapted again in 1957, and then in 1968 it was adapted into a 7-part series.
Hmm.
And Jenny Agutter is in that part.
Hmm.
So she was in that and the movie. And actually, Lionel Jeffries, interesting, the first time he read the book was while he was filming a movie you definitely have heard of, if not seen, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I've not seen it, but I certainly
but you know of it.
Oh yeah, of course. Okay. Dick Van Dyke.
I mean, I've seen it so long ago that I might as well not have seen it. Like. Yeah. But then, so Lionel Jeffries was in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh.
So he was an actor, and he didn't make the movie, but he was in it.
Cool.
So I guess the other big thing I want to ask you about is the ending.
Hmm.
Because, I mean, like we said, it is a series of vignettes. The father does end up returning.
Yes.
Because we find out, I don't know what happened. So he said he's on trial. We see the newspaper article that says
he's been sentenced to
five years.
Yeah.
Bobby sends a note. Like, she sends something that the old man transports for her, and then we see the guy come back. So does her note have anything to do with it?
I don't think so. I think she's trying to ask him for help, and I think he was kind of interested in the case anyways. Because
maybe hooked him up with a better lawyer or something.
Yeah, he didn't think he'd done it.
Yeah.
They obviously worked through the system in a way that got him released.
Right. So essentially, she gets her dad released.
Yeah, so we have the end of the movie where the train pulls up, and there's all the steam and smoke that's around, and then the train pulls away, and then there's Daddy on the platform.
Yeah, it's a really well done little emotional moment there. And, okay, go ahead.
I was going to say, and then, of course, she brings him home and lets him into the house, and then grabs the other kids and says, we better go away for a few moments.
To let them fuck, right?
Yeah.
It's exactly what I thought. There's another scene in this movie, too, that there's an implied sex scene
between
Perks and his wife.
Yeah, where Perks is in the bed, and they're getting ready
he pulls the privacy shade.
Yeah.
And then what does she say?
She says something like, oh, all right, it's your birthday. And then he like reaches out and decides he's going to grab a beer to take in with him. And I assume drink that beer while she blows him. I don't know. But something
Why
happens. Why not?
Why not?
That's a good life.
If he spills it, he spills it.
That's right.
But I was going to talk about the very ending too, because the very end of the movie is like the Beverly Hillbillies, because they're all just waving at the camera.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a slow like moving on the tracks. Everybody's waving, and then it gets up close to Roberta, just holding up a chalkboard that says like the end.
Yeah, we see her writing it,
yeah.
And then we see her holding it up. And I don't know. It's kind of interesting. It's a complete fourth wall break at the beginning, at the end of the movie. Mm. There's been nothing really like that leading up to that.
It's the end of the movie. You can do shit like that.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to bring it up, see what you thought about that.
It was fun. Everybody, they had the train set up. It was all decorated.
It's like a cast. What do you call it? Not a casting call. Like a roll call thing at the end where, you know, you watch a Broadway performance. Everybody comes out and does the bow. It kind of reminded me of that.
Like Animal House where they tell you where everybody went to?
No. Not like Animal House. Ask for Babs. No. I'm talking about like at the end of a play specifically where everyone kind of comes out and takes their bow.
Takes their bow, yeah.
Yeah. And then everyone bows together. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice.
It's kind of interesting.
It even gives it a much more like ensemble feel that way. It's like we all were in on this.
We're all a bunch of crazy kids.
That's right.
Any other big things you want to talk about before we go into your bits and bobs?
Nothing specifically. Maybe in my bits and bobs I'll find something I forgot.
Okay. Well, on that note then, we are going to take a brief commercial break. We're here from some lovely sponsors at Age of Radio, and we will be right back.
Age of Radio.
Maybe tomorrow I'll have some bits and bobs.
Until tomorrow, I'll read my bits and bobs.
We're living on the edge of bits and bobsies.
Bits and bobs are the thing I want to read.
I'm at Bits and Bobsies in Cincinnati. That was our best one yet.
Yeah, it was. Trains. Trains in the old days were the toy of choice, weren't they, Brennan? That was a really fucking nice train he had, because I think it was actually like coal-powered.
Yeah.
Like it must have had like a water thing in it. He had to set a fire to get it to go. Like that's pretty fucking cool.
Can I put on my film glasses for a second?
Sure.
My small glasses?
Do it.
I think the train is very symbolic in this movie. It's very like, as soon as that train blows up, there's an issue.
Yeah.
And then we didn't even mention this scene, but they save a train from getting derailed.
Yeah, that's one of the vignettes. There's a landslide in front of the track, and they run down and take off their bloomers, which are red, and they wave them in front of the train to get the train to stop. And for some reason, Roberta stays on the track as
and
the
passes,
train...
I think she has a nervous...
Yeah, a nervous breakdown or an anxiety attack or something, and she passes out. But the fact that she's like staying in the middle of the track, yeah, no wonder you get anxiety attacks. There's a fucking train coming at your face. Get off the track.
Jenny Agutter.
Get off the goddamn track. That wouldn't have stopped a train. Her body. It's very soft.
but what I was going to say is, yeah, so and then when they save that train, Jason, that is the moment where Perks brings Peter his toy train and says, hey, I fixed it.
Yes.
And it's almost like, oh, everything's starting to turn around. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, maybe it's a very basic, like this train got saved and this toy train got fixed, but I thought it was an interesting tie-in.
It's just an indication that things are indeed coming up Milhouse.
Yes. Very much so.
I found it funny. Now, obviously, every movie we watch generally has a disclaimer about, like, you know, the person in this or fictitious or whatever. I just found it really weird that that disclaimer was on the actual writing credit in the credit sequence to this movie.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, it's, like, written by Lionel...
Jeffries.
And then at the bottom in small print, it's like, any, you know, resemblance to fictitious, they're all fictitious. Just fuck off. That's what it said.
That's Phyllis, who means well.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. That made me laugh. Yeah.
Because Phyllis is kind of a...
That's what you say about someone where you can't think of anything nice to say about them.
Yeah. She's sweet and everything, but she's kind of, I don't want to say dumb, but you know,
she's a kid.
She's
a kid, yeah.
She's 11 years old.
I thought it was funny when they're getting their picture taken and they set the bird on fire and they all think that's really hilarious, which is exactly how kids would react. They wouldn't be scared. They'd think that was really funny.
I like that the father that they love so much, the kids love so much, gets a freeze frame introduction and glorious music playing.
Mm-hmm.
They really love that father.
Absolutely. So we briefly meet their Aunt Emma.
Can we play the music cue?
Yes, let's play the fucking music cue.
Let's just play the music cue for Aunt Emma.
And Aunt Emma came on a visit.
And then, by the way, it proceeds to be a white lady.
Yeah.
Thank God. I was worried that it was going to be someone in brown face.
You know, absolutely. You assume with this sort of music cue that it was, you know, like many sorts of music cues, it's shorthand for a given ethnicity. So she comes in and the sitar is playing. So you think, wait, is this lady Indian? Possibly. But no.
Nope.
The connection is she's eventually going to India or she's been to India. And she's wearing a hat that resembles a pith helmet.
Yeah.
So she's very colonial.
And she comes in and she's very much like, you may kiss me if you want.
Yeah.
I don't like children. I think children should be seen rather than heard. And actually, you know what? I don't even think they should be seen. I also thought, oh, we're introducing her as a major villain, but that's her only scene.
No, she's like literally in it for a sec.
Oh, and then they have a scene. Sorry, they do have a bit later where they ask before they go to Yorkshire, is Aunt Emma coming with us? And then their mother's like, no, I'm afraid not. And then it slowly pans over to Aunt Emma. And then that sitar music kicks in for like another second.
When they get to town.
Oh, it's because she's going to be a governess in India. That's what it is.
Yes, yeah. So, of course, she's very prim and proper.
Yeah.
I like that when they get to the town, their first thing they think they should do for fun is walk along the railway tracks. Watch out, kids. Trains are heavy.
Controversy about this movie, by the way. In 2013, the British Board of Film Classification actually had a complaint about the movie that it encouraged children to play on the railway tracks.
Yeah.
And they defended it basically by saying, well, the children go on the railway tracks, but the reason they do is to warn about a collision. They're not going to like play on the
later
tracks
in the movie. But when they first get to town, they're like hopping along and running along the railway tracks as they walk into town to go to the station for the first time and meet Perks.
They also said that the film, their defense about that, Jason, because that did come up. Oh, what about the other times? They said, well, the film was set in Edwardian times when access to railway lines were not under the same restrictions as modern times.
Certainly not. And people didn't care as much because there had been less people murdered by trains.
Yes.
So they bring the drunk doctor over at one point and mom's sick and he says she has the flu, but she'll be fine. Now, I get that nowadays the flu isn't as big a deal, but it still is a big deal. I would think in 1905, the flu would be a much bigger deal, especially given what happens later on with the Spanish flu after World War I. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they can't see into the future at that point, but come on, guys. It's the flu. It's not. You got to take that shit seriously.
There's a really sweet scene where they have a surprise party for Bobby.
Because
she's the one we're following, right?
Yes.
And she's putting a lot of effort in to get stuff done. She's basically, you know, helping the other kids. And they throw her a surprise birthday party. And I just think it's such a lovely scene. And I don't know if this is true, but the way it looked like to me, so she's like kind of backing up and, you know, everybody's kind of saying, oh, happy birthday. Perks is there. Everything, right? Did it seem to you like she might have been on like a track or something?
Yes, when she's talking to everybody and she's kind of like falling backwards almost through the room, you know, she's definitely on like a track or on a wheeled board or something.
Like it almost looks like she's floating.
Yeah, it's very magical.
It was like a sweet thing because it was just like it was kind of like, oh, she's kind of floating right now. Like she's kind of so happy.
Yeah, exactly. She knows everybody loves her and appreciates her and everybody's there. Her mom, her siblings, Mr. Perks, like, you know, everybody's there and it's a lovely time.
Yeah. Yeah. I just really like that song.
Very heartwarming. I love at one point, somebody says something about a big garden, great big garden squirt. I think Peter says it. And then, what's her face? The middle child. Phyllis responds with, "You're a great big garden squirt."
He responds
with, "Well, thank you."
Didn't it seem like a very modern joke? Like,
yeah, well, just especially the way that Peter responds by just being like, "Oh, thank you."
Oh, okay. I just meant like you know, something something towel. You're a towel.
Yeah.
Like
they were ahead of the game on that one.
Yeah.
I assume South Park stole it from this movie as well.
Of course. Trey Parker, big railway children fan.
At one point, mom sees a newspaper with some information on it about dad, and so she burns it.
Yes, but then Bobby finds it later.
Bobby finds it later and finds out the real truth.
Finally finds out that he was accused of being a spy.
Once they save the day with the train, they're bestowed their title of the railway children.
Okay, I got a little bit of a pitch here for you,
sure.
Jason. This should have been a weekly series. The railway children just like solving mysteries and shit?
Well, actually, I know you're joking too, but like this concept could make a good weekly TV series because of the vignette nature of the movie.
Oh,
it's
no.
Just little shit that happens in the town all day.
I'm kind of joking, but I am fully serious. Like this could have been a weekly show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It'd be like The Wind at My Back, a Canadian TV show about two kids growing up in like the 30s and Canada. Similar idea where you could have a different story every week. I'm surprised they never like tried to turn this into a running TV show.
I think it could really work as like, I think if it was adapted now instead of like, you know, in 1970, I think that's how they would go about it.
Yeah. You could keep this thing going as long as the kids were of an age where you thought that they were cute.
Even just like a mini series.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they did right in 2000.
Did they? Oh, a 7-part. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That was in 1968 though.
Well, the 2000 one, was that just a TV movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
We
had a fun thing with the band at the station during the celebration of the railway children being named, the railway children, where the band is trying to play a song and the trumpet gut player keeps fucking it up, and eventually the band leader realizes he has the wrong notes, so he switches the paper with another guy, and then everything sounds great, but then, of course, he turns around and the kids are gone.
I didn't even put together when I watched the movie. I didn't even see that. I didn't even notice that scene. It was so subtle.
Yeah, it was just happening. They would occasionally flick back to it, and I'm like, what, is the trumpet player drunk or stupid or something? But no, he had the wrong notes. Yeah, everyone waves and Daddy's home. Bits and bobs. Completed.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about a little bit of the awards here.
Sure.
No Oscars.
What?
Doesn't go to the Oscars, nothing. But at the BAFTAs, it does get nominated for a few things. It does get nominated for Best Supporting Actor for Bernard Cribbins as Mr. Perks, thankfully. The winner is someone we've already talked about, Colin Welland in Kess, the teacher from Kess.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Which in probably, Kess?
What?
For Kess?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Which I think is probably deserved. It
wow,
was really
this
good.
Movie was made the same year as Kess.
Yeah, Kess came out in 1969.
Kess's budget must have been fucking nothing, because that looks like shit compared to this movie.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, you could argue, too, that part of it's the gritty nature of the movie.
Yeah, but I don't think Kess looks like shit.
It's just, it's a much dirtier looking type of film.
I mean, it's not an uplifting movie as this.
Absolutely.
More than this is.
Absolutely.
It's also nominated for Best Original Music. Winner that year is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it is nominated for Most Promising Newcomer for Sally Tomsett, who plays Phyllis.
Oh, wow.
But the winner that year is David Bradley and Kess,
there
the
we go.
Main child, which, again, probably deserved.
Deserving, absolutely.
Yeah. This movie had a huge lasting impression on the British film industry.
Mm.
It's obviously on the BFI Top 100. The film magazine Total Film placed it as the 46th greatest British film of the 20th century. In 2005, the BFI included it on their list of the 50 films you should see by the age of 14.
Mm-hmm.
So this is weird. I'll read this and then we'll just briefly discuss this. In 2008, the movie made it onto Channel 4's list of the 100 greatest family films at number 30, just ahead of Monsters, Inc. Fine. Okay. And behind Men in Black and Ghostbusters. Those are not family films.
I mean,
no.
I think you can watch them as a family, but I wouldn't consider them a family film.
They're not a family film.
But Ghostbusters, you have to remember too, especially, was and Men in Black even. They were super appealing to kids, but also adults.
Sure, but I mean, it's not Monsters, Inc.
No, absolutely not. Like, yeah, Ghostbusters is not a family film in the way that Good Monsters, Inc. or The Railway Children is a family film. But it is a film that, like, multiple generations of people can watch.
See, to me, for the most part, family film is nothing beyond just PG.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, the regular PG, not PG-13. Like,
I mean,
PG and down.
Well, Ghostbusters is PG, isn't it?
13.
I don't think there's much.
It's definitely
PG-13. Oh, was 13 out
oh,
by
yeah.
then?
Oh, it might not have been out by then, but I mean, now it would be PG-13.
I mean, there's no F-bombs dropped, is there?
No, but there's other words.
Although he does say this man has a small penis, doesn't he?
Yeah, there's. I think it would be PG-13 these days for sure.
Or this man has no penis, maybe.
Yeah. But yeah, that's basically all I have. Don't have a whole lot of information. We talked about this movie, Jason, but are you gonna go play with the trains? Are you? How do
yeah.
you feel about the Railway Children?
Absolutely, this movie was utterly charming and enjoyable and funny and heartfelt and. Loved everybody in it. All the actors were great. Like, I mean, I would love to sit here and give you a rant of why I hated this movie, but I can't because I enjoyed it very much.
It was pleasant.
It was very pleasant. Yeah, it's not a bad movie to watch with grandma at all.
Yeah. It's not anything I would be like, oh shit, man, you gotta fucking watch The Railway Children.
Your mind will get blown, man.
But if it was like, hey, I'm really into British movies, old British movies, and I have kids, is there any cross-section here? I'd be like, The Railway Children.
I wonder if kids today would enjoy this movie just because it's such an old-fashioned kind of thing, but also...
The right age, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's great. I love the kids. I think it's a genuine relationship. It's positive. It's
you gotta condition them.
Yeah.
You gotta condition the kids to like old movies. At the beginning, you hook them while they're young, just like the tobacco industry.
They're 5 years old, so now we shall watch Casablanca.
Get ready for Maltese Falcon
That's
next
right.
week.
You're gonna love Bogey. You're gonna want to smoke so hard.
So Jason, I guess we're coming to that. Yeah, so I mean, I guess I kind of interjected a little bit here, but yeah, overall, I also thought it was pleasant. It was nice. It was fluffy in the best way.
Yes.
Like it was really well filmed. The actors were charming. Mm. Bernard Cribbins especially.
Oh,
I think he's a real standout
Wonderful.
Here. As well as Jenny Agutter,
yeah.
like as the lead. I think she's very good for, especially, you know, how young she was at the time. Still can't believe she's the nurse in American Werewolf in London. Also great in that movie. But Yeah, no, I think it's great. I don't know, like, if it would place, like, super high, but I think it's on... I think I would put it on that on the list anyway.
I think it'd definitely be in the upper tier.
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure yet. I think it's very solid, and it's a lot of fun, and it's very pleasant, and I had a great time watching it.
Yeah. All right.
It's hard to answer right now. You'll find out when we get to the end of this 20 batch.
Without violating any copyrights, you might say that some of our fingers are pointing to the sky.
Sure.
Yeah.
What is that a reference to? Oh, a little S&E.
Mm-hmm.
So now, Jason, we come to the time where we are going to find out what we're talking about on this here program next week.
Here we go, baby.
And I believe it is your roll. We are going to, Jason is going to roll some dice here. And the number he gets on those dice will be the number on the BFI Top 100 that we are going to talk about next week.
And as often happens nowadays, since we were through most of the list, this might take a few rolls, so bear with us.
Yeah. So Jason has a 10s D10, which is a green. That's the 10s D10. Mm-hmm. And a red D10. And we're going to find out. Jason, let's carry on up that Kyber. Come on.
It's finally time. Let's see what we get here.
Okay.
50.
50s, okay.
Well, it's not carry on up the Kyber, but
it's not going to be unless you get a repeat.
58.
Wow, you picked the only one.
Nice.
The only one. There's three. Sorry. Okay. 58, Jason. This trivia for everyone almost was our first episode.
Oh, we're finally doing The Man in the White Suit.
We're finally doing The Man in the White Suit, right. 1951, directed by Alexander McKendrick.
Here I'm excited. We go.
Alec Guinness back again.
It's been a long time.
It really hasn't.
No, it hasn't at all.
Lavender Hill Mob was like five episodes
ago. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll talk about The Man in the White Suit, another Ealing Studios comedy.
Sweet.
I think we're running out of those. We must be. But until then, you can find us all over social media. You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at BFI_pod. You can find us on all the podcast apps. Age of Radio, of course, is our home base. ageofradio.org/forscreenandcountry. You can find Jason on Twitter.
At Jason D. McLeod. That's MacLeod. And special shout out to that one guy that signed up for a Twitter account and only follows me and Brendan. So
woo!
Thanks. I mean, I always say stuff. I mean, I don't say that much on Twitter. If you like some sweet retweets, but thank you. Thank you, person, for following us.
And bear with Jason's Twitter because sometimes his Wi-Fi is not that great on the train.
Yeah.
So you might see like a few like incomplete tweets.
The train. Like this city has a train, Brendan.
Jason, we have so... Don't get me started on the amount of trains we have.
Our
in the
train
city.
Station is a liquor store now, for guys. That's a fact.
But yeah, that's the shit. That's the stuff.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about. We're going to talk about The Man in the White Suit.
Ooh, sort of unlike The Lady in the Blue Dress.
Yeah, but a lot like Lady in Red.
Shout out to Monica Lewinsky. You're doing God's work. We love you.
That was me kissing the sky.
I excuse you.
Thank you. Oh, but Jason, until next week, I just have to say to you, God save the queen.
God save the screen.
And for Screen and Country, I'm Brendan.
And I'm Jason.
High five.
Fuck yeah. Episode complete. Booyah. Print it, motherfucker.
I'm sitting in the railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts are escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Every day is an endless stream of cigarettes and magazines. Ooh. And each town looks the same to me, the movies and the factories, and every stranger's face I see reminds me that I long to be. Homeward bound, I wish I was. Homeward bound, home, where my thoughts are sleeping. Home.